window behind him. The desk was wider than the window, and the ends of it met the wall, which prevented it from sailing straight through the glass. But Hal was in the center of the window, and the low sill hit him behind the knees, so nothing inhibited his plunge. For an instant, the jangling level-o'er blinds seemed as if they might restrain him, but that was wishful thinking. He carried them with him, through the glass and into the night, dropping the Browning without ever having fired it. He was surprised at how long it took to fall 6 stories, which was not such a terribly great distance, though a deadly one. He had time to marvel at how slowly the lighted office window receded from him, time to think about people he had loved and dreams never fulfilled, time even to notice that the clouds, which had returned at twilight, were shedding light sprinkles of rain. His last thought was about the garden behind his small house in Costa Mesa, where he tended an array of flowers year-round and secretly enjoyed every moment of it, the exquisitely soft texture of a coral-red impatiens petal, and on its edge a single tiny drop of morning dew glistening.
Candy shoved the heavy desk aside and leaned out of the 6th-floor window. A cool updraft rose along the side of the building and buffeted his face. The shoeless man lay on his back on a broad concrete walk below, illuminated by the amber backsplash of a landscape spotlight. He was surrounded by broken glass, tangled metal blinds, and a swiftly spreading blot of his own blood. Coughing, still having a little difficulty drawing deep enough breaths, with one hand pressed to the stinging flesh of his battered throat, Candy was upset by the man's death. Actually, not by the fact of it, but by the timing of it. First, he'd wanted to interrogate him to learn who Bobby and Julie were, and what association they had with the psychic, Thomas. And when Candy had teleported into the reception lounge, the guy had thought he was Frank. He had spoken Frank's name. The people at Dakota and Dakota were somehow associated with Frank, knew all about his ability to teleport, and therefore would know where to find the mother-murdering wretch. Candy supposed the office would hold answers to at least some of his questions, but he was concerned that police responding to the dead man's plunge would necessitate a departure before he turned up all the information he needed. Sirens were the background music to this night's adventures. No sirens had arisen yet, however. Maybe he had gotten lucky, maybe no one had seen the man fall. It was unlikely that anyone was at work at any of the other companies in the office building. It was, after all, 9:10. Perhaps janitors were polishing floors somewhere or emptying waste baskets, but they might not have heard enough to warrant investigation. The man had plummeted to his death with surprisingly little protest. He had not screamed. An instant before impact, the start of a shout had flown from him, but it had been too short to attract notice. The explosion of the glass and the tinny clanging of the blinds had been loud enough, but the action had been over before anyone could have located the source of the sound. A 4-lane street encircled the Fashion Island Shopping Center, and also served the office towers that, like this one, stood on the outer rim. Apparently, however, no cars had been on it when the man had fallen. Now, 2 appeared to the left, one behind the other. Both passed without slowing. A row of shrubberies between the sidewalk and the street prevented motorists from seeing the corpse where it lay. The office tower ring of the sprawling complex was clearly not an area that attracted pedestrians at night, so the dead man might remain undiscovered until morning. He looked across the street at the restaurants and stores that were on this flank of the mall, 500 or 600 yards away. A few people on foot, shrunken by distance, moved between the parked cars and the entrances to the businesses. No one appeared to have seen anything, and in fact it would not have been that easy to spot a darkly dressed man plunging past a mostly dark building, aloft and visible for only seconds before gravity finished him. Candy cleared his throat, wincing in pain, and spat toward the dead man below. He tasted blood. This time, it was his own. Turning away from the window, he surveyed the office, wondering where he would find the answers he sought. If he could locate Bobby and Julie Dakota, they might be able to explain Thomas's telepathy, and more important, they might be able to deliver Frank into his hands.
After twice responding to an alarm from the radar detector and avoiding two speed traps in the West Valley, Julie cranked the Toyota back up to 85 and they dusted L.A. off their heels. A few raindrops spattered the windshield, but the sprinkles did not last. She switched the wipers off moments after turning them on. "Santa Barbara in maybe an hour," she said, "as long as a cop with a sense of duty doesn't come along." The back of her neck ached, and she was deeply weary. But she didn't want to trade places with Bobby. She didn't have the patience to be a passenger tonight. Her eyes were sore but not heavy. She could not possibly have slept. The events of the day had murdered sleep, and alertness was assured by concern about what might lie ahead, not just on the highway before them, but in El Encanto Heights. Ever since he'd been awakened by what he called the word burst, Bobby had been moody. She could tell he was worried about something, but he didn't seem to want to talk about it yet. After a while, in an obvious attempt to take his mind off the word burst and whatever gloomy ruminations it had inspired, he tried to strike up a conversation about something utterly different. He lowered the volume on the stereo, thereby frustrating the intended effect of Glenn Miller's American Patrol, and said, "You ever stop to think 4 out of our 11 employees are Asian Americans?" She didn't glance away from the road. "So?" "So why is that, do you think?" "Because we hire only first-rate people. And it so happened that 4 of the first-rate people who wanted to work for us were Chinese, Japanese, and Vietnamese." "Well, that's part of it." "Just part," she said. "So, what's the other part?" "You think maybe the wicked Fu Manchu turned a mind-control ray on us from his secret fortress in the Tibetan mountains and made us hire him?" "Well, that's part of it, too," he said. "But another part of it is, I'm attracted to the Asian personality, or to what people think of when they think of the Asian personality: intelligence, a high degree of self-discipline, neatness, strong sense of tradition and order." "Those are pretty much traits of everyone who works for us, not just Jamie Nguyen Hallen Lee." "I know, I know. But what makes me so comfortable with Asian Americans is that I buy into the stereotype of them. I feel everything will go along in an orderly, stable fashion when I'm working with them. And I need to buy into that stereotype because, well, I'm not the kind of guy I've always thought I was." "Are you ready to hear something shocking?" "Always," Julie said. Often when Lee Chen was laboring in the computer room, he popped a CD into his Sony Discman and listened to music through earphones. He always kept the door closed to avoid distraction, and no doubt some of his fellow employees thought he was somewhat antisocial. However, when he was engaged in the penetration of a complex and well-protected data network like the array of police systems he was still plundering, he needed to concentrate. Occasionally, music distracted him as much as anything, depending on his mood, but most of the time it was conducive to his work. The minimalist New Age piano solos of George Winston were sometimes just the thing. But more often he needed rock and roll. Tonight it was Huey Lewis and the News, Hip to Be Square, and The Power of Love, The Heart of Rock and Roll, and You Crack Me Up. Focused intently on the terminal screen, his window on the mesmerizing world of cyberspace, with Bad is Bad pouring into his ears through the headset, he might not have heard a thing if, in the world outside, God had peeled back the sky and announced the imminent destruction of the human race.
A cool draft circulated through the room from the broken window, but growing frustration generated a compensatory heat in Candy. He moved slowly around the spacious office, handling various objects, touching the furniture, trying to finesse a vision that would reveal the whereabouts of the Dakotas and Frank. Thus far, he'd had no luck. He could have pored through the contents of the desk drawers and filing cabinets, but that would have taken hours, since he didn't know where they might have filed the information he was seeking. He also realized he might not recognize the right stuff when he found it, for it might be in a folder or envelope bearing a case name or code that was meaningless to him. And though his mother had taught him to read and write, and though he had been a voracious reader just like her until he lost interest in books upon her death, teaching himself many subjects as well as any university could have done, he nevertheless trusted what his special gifts could reveal to him more than anything he might find on paper. Besides, he had already stepped into the lounge, obtained the Dakota's home address and phone number, and called to see if they were there. An answering machine had picked up on the third ring, and he had left no message. He didn't just want to know where the Dakotas lived, where they might turn up in time. He needed to know where they were now, this minute, because he was in a fever to get at them and wring answers from them. He picked up a third scotch and soda glass. They were all over the room. The psychic residue on the tumbler gave him an instant vivid image of a man named Jackie Jacks, and he pitched it aside in anger. It bounced off the sofa under the carpet without shattering. This Jacks person left a colorful and noisy psychic impression everywhere in his wake, the way a dog with poor bladder control would mark each step on his route with a dribble of stinking urine. Candy sensed that Jacks was currently with a large number of people at a party in Newport Beach, and he also sensed that trying to find Frank or the Dakotas through Jacks would be wasted effort. Even so, if Jacks had been alone now, easily taken, Candy would have gone straight to him and slaughtered him, just because the guy's lingering aura was so brassy and annoying. Either he had not yet found an object that one of the Dakotas had touched long enough to leave an imprint, or neither of them was the type who left a rich, lingering psychic residue in his wake. For reasons Candy could not fathom, some people were harder to trace than others. He had always found tracing Frank to be of medium difficulty, but tonight catching that scent was harder than usual. Repeatedly he sensed that Frank had been in the room, but at first he could locate nothing in which the aura of his brother was coagulated. Next he turned to the four chairs, beginning with the largest. When he skimmed his sensitive fingertips lightly over the upholstery, he quivered with excitement, for he knew at once that Frank had sat there recently. A small tear marred the vinyl on one arm, and when Candy put his thumb upon the rent, particularly vivid visions of Frank assaulted him. Too many visions. He was rewarded with a whole series of place images, where Frank had traveled after rising from the chair, the High Sierras, the apartment in San Diego in which he had lived briefly 4 years ago, the rusted front gate of their mother's house on Pacific Hill Road, a graveyard, a book-lined study in which he'd stayed such a short time that Candy could only get the vaguest impression of it, Punaloo Beach, where Candy had nearly caught him. There were so many images, from so many travels, layered one atop another that he could not clearly see the later stops. Disgusted, he pushed the chair out of his way and turned to the coffee table where two more tumblers stood. Both contained melted ice and scotch. He picked one up and had a vision of Julie Dakota.
While Julie drove toward Santa Barbara as if they were competing in time trials for the Indianapolis 500, Bobby told her the shocking thing, that he was not, at heart, the laid-back guy he appeared to be on the surface, that during his hectic travels with Frank, especially during the moments when he had been reduced to a disembodied mind and a frantic whirl of disconnected atoms, he discovered within himself a rich vein of love for stability and order that ran deeper than he ever could have imagined, a motherlode of stick-in-the-mudness, that his delight in swing music arose more from an appreciation for the meticulosity of its structures than for the dizzying musical freedom embodied in jazz, that he was not half the free-spirited man he thought he was, and far more of a conservative embracer of tradition than he would have hoped. In short, he said, all this time you thought you were married to an easygoing young James Garner type. You've actually been wed to an any-age Charles Bronson type. Oh, I can live with you anyway, Charlie. Oh, this is serious, sort of. I've tipped into my late 30s. I'm no child. I should have known this about myself a long time ago. You did. Huh? You love order, reason, logic. That's why you got into the line of work where you could right wrongs, help the innocent, punish the bad. That's why you share the dream with me, so we can get our little family in order, step out of the chaos of the world as it is these days, and buy into some peace and quiet. That's why you won't let me have the Wurlitzer 950. Those bubble tubes and leaping gazelles are just a little too chaotic for you. He was silent a moment, surprised by her answer. The lightless vastness of the sea lay to the west. He said, "Maybe you're right. Maybe I've always known what I am deep down. But then isn't it unnerving that I fooled myself with my own act for so long? You haven't. You're easygoing and a bit of Charles Bronson, which is a good thing. Otherwise we probably couldn't communicate at all, since I've got more Bronson in me than anyone but Bronson." "God, that's true," he said, and they both laughed. The Toyota's speed had declined to under 70. She put it up to 80 and said, "Bobby, what's really on your mind?" "Thomas." She glanced at him. "What about Thomas?" "Since that word burst, I can't shake the feeling he's in danger." "What did that have to do with him?" "I don't know. But I'd feel better if we could find a phone and put a call into Cielo Vista, just to be sure." She let their speed fall dramatically. Within 3 miles, they exited the freeway and pulled into a service station. There was a full-service lane. While the attendant washed their windows, checked the oil, and filled the tank with premium unleaded, they went inside and used the payphone. It was a modern electronic version, allowing everything from coin to credit calls, on the wall next to a rack of snack crackers, candy bars, and packages of beer nuts. A condom machine was there, too, right out in the open, thanks to the social chaos wrought by AIDS. Using their AT&T credit card, Bobby called Cielo Vista Care Home in Newport. It didn't ring or give a busy signal. He heard an odd series of electronic sounds, then a recording informed him that the number he had dialed was temporarily out of service as a result of unspecified line problems. The droning voice suggested that he try later. He dialed the operator, who tried the same number with the same results. She said, "I'm sorry, sir. Please call your party later." What line problem could they be having? "I wouldn't know, sir, but I'm sure service will be restored soon." He had tilted the phone away from his ear so Julie could lean in and hear both sides of the exchange. When he hung up, he looked at her. "Well, let's go back. I've got this hunch. Thomas needs us." "Go back? We're little more than half an hour from Santa Barbara now. Much further to go home. He may need us. It's not a strong hunch, I admit, but it's persistent and weird." "If he needs help urgently," she said, "then we'd never get to him in time anyway. And if it's not so urgent, he'll be okay if we go on to Santa Barbara. Call him from the motel. If he's sick or been hurt or something, the extra driving from here to Santa Barbara and back will only add about an hour." "Well, he's my brother, Bobby. I care about him as much as you do. And I say it'll be all right. I love you, but you've never shown enough talent as a psychic to make me hysterical about this." He nodded. "You're right. I'm just jumpy. My nerves haven't settled down since all that traveling with Frank." Back on the highway, a few thin tendrils of fog were creeping in from the sea. Sprinkles of rain fell again, then stopped after less than a minute. The heaviness of the air and the indefinable but undeniable quality of oppressiveness in the utterly black night sky portended a major storm. When they had gone a couple of miles, Bobby said, "I should have called Hal at the office. While he's sitting around there waiting for Frank, he could use some of our contacts with the phone company and the cops to make sure everything's Jake at Cielo Vista." "If the lines are still out when you make the call from the motel," Julie said, "then you can bother Hal about it."
From the weak psychic residue on the drinking glass, Candy received an image of Julie Dakota that was recognizably the same face that had seeped from Thomas's mind earlier in the evening, except that it was not as idealized as it had been in Thomas's memory. With his sixth sense, he saw that she had gone home from the office to the address he had obtained earlier from the secretary's Rolodex. She had been there a short time, then had gone somewhere in a car with another person, most likely the man named Bobby. He could see no more, and he wished that the traces she left behind had been as strong as those of Jack's. He put down the tumbler and decided to go to her house. Though she and Bobby were not there now, he might be able to find an object that would, like the liquor glass, lead him another step or two along their trail. If he found nothing, he could return here and continue his search, assuming the police had not arrived in response to the discovery of the dead man outside.
Lee switched off the computer, then cut off the CD player, too. Huey Lewis and the news were in the middle of Walking on a Thin Line, and removed the earphones. Happy after a long and productive session in the land of silicon and gallium arsenide, he stood, stretched, yawned, and checked his watch. Little after 9. He'd been at work for 12 hours. He should have wanted nothing more than to flop in bed and sleep half a day, but he figured he'd zip back to his condo, which was 10 minutes from the office, freshen up, and catch some nightlife. Last week, he'd found a new club, Nuclear Grin, where the music was loud and hard-edged, the drinks unwatered, the crowd's politics unconsciously libertarian, and the women hot. He wanted to dance a little, drink a little, and find someone who wanted to screw her brains out. In this age of new diseases, sex was risky. It sometimes seemed that drinking from the same glass as someone else was suicidal. But after a day in the painstakingly logical microchip universe, you had to get a little wild, take some risks, dance on the edge of chaos to get some balance in your life. Then he remembered how Frank and Bobby had vanished in front of his eyes. He wondered if maybe he hadn't already had enough wildness for one day. He picked up the latest printouts. It was more stuff that he had gleaned from police records regarding the decidedly weird behavior of Mr. Blue, who would never need to get a little wild for balance, since he was already chaos walking around in shoes. Lee opened the door, switched off the light, went down the hall and through another door into the lounge, intending to leave the printouts on Julie's desk and say goodnight to Hal before splitting. When he walked into Bobby and Julie's office, it looked like the National Wrestling Federation had sanctioned a match between tag teams of 300-pound hulks. Furniture was overturned, and scotch glasses, some of them broken, were scattered over the floor. Julie's desk was aslant and askew, tilting on one shattered leg. The top no longer was properly aligned with the base, as if someone had gone at it with pry bars and hammers. Hal? No answer. Gingerly, he pushed open the door of the adjoining bath. Hal? The bathroom was deserted. He went to the broken window. A few small shards of glass still clung to the frame, caught the light, jagged. With one hand against the wall, Lee Chen carefully leaned out. He looked down. In a much different tone of voice, he said, "Hal."
Candy materialized in the foyer of the Dakota's house, which was dark and silent. He stood quietly for a moment, head cocked, until he was confident that he was alone. His throat was healed, he was whole again, and excited by the prospects of the night. He began the search from there, putting his hand on the doorknob, in hope of finding some of the residue that, while lacking physical substance, nevertheless provided the nourishment for his visions. He felt nothing. No doubt partly because the Dakotas had touched it only briefly upon entering and departing the house. Of course, a person could handle 100 items, leaving psychic images of himself on only one of them, then touch the same 100 an hour later and contaminate every one with his aura. The reason for that was as mysterious to Candy as was so many people's interest in sex. He remained as grateful to his mother for this talent as he was for all the others, but tracking his prey with psychometry was not always an easy or infallible process. The Dakota's living room and dining room were unfurnished, which gave him little to work with, although for some reason the emptiness made him feel comfortable and at home. That response puzzled him. The rooms in his mother's house were all furnished, as much with mold and fungus and dust these days as with chairs, sofas, tables, and lamps. But he suddenly realized that, like the Dakotas, he lived in such a small percentage of the house that most of its chambers might as well have been bare, carpetless, and sealed off. The Dakotas' kitchen and family room were furnished and obviously lived in, though it was unlikely that they had used the family room during their brief stop between the office and wherever they had gone from here. He hoped they might have lingered in the kitchen for a bite of food or a drink. But the handles of the cabinets, microwave, oven, and refrigerator provided him with no images whatsoever. On his way to the second floor, Kendi climbed the steps slowly, letting his left hand slide searchingly along the oak balustrade. At several points along the way, he was rewarded by psychic images that, while brief and not clear, encouraged him and led him to believe that he would find what he needed in their bedroom or bath.
Instead of immediately dialing 911 to report the murder of Hal Yamataka, Lee ran first to the reception desk and, as he'd been trained, removed a small brown notebook from the back of the bottom drawer on the right side. For the benefit of employees like Lee, who did not often get into the field and seldom interface directly with the county's many police agencies, but might one day need to deal with them in an emergency, Bobby had composed a list of some of the officers, detectives, and administrators who were most professional, reasonable, and reliable in every major jurisdiction. The brown notebook contained a second list of cops to avoid, those who had an instinctive dislike for anyone in the private investigation and security business, those who were just pains in the ass in general, and those who were always on the lookout for a little green grease to lubricate the wheels of justice. It was a testament to the high quality of the county's law enforcement that the first list was much longer than the second. According to Bobby and Julie, it was preferable to try to manage the introduction of the police into a situation that required them, even going so far as to try to select one of the detectives who would show up at the scene, if it was a scene that needed detectives. Relying on the luck of the draw or a dispatcher's whim was considered unwise. Lee wondered if he should even call the cops. He had no doubt who had killed Hal, Mr. Blue, Kendi. But also, he knew that Bobby would not want to reveal more about Frank and the case than was truly necessary. The agency client privilege was not as legally airtight as that of lawyer client or doctor patient, but it was important, too. Since Julie and Bobby were on the road and temporarily unreachable, Lee could get no guidance on what and how much he should say to the police. But he couldn't let the dead body lie in front of the building, hoping nobody would notice, especially not when the victim was a man he had known and liked. Call the cops, then, but play dumb. Consulting the notebook, Lee dialed the Newport Beach police and asked for Detective Harry Ladsbroke, but Ladsbroke was off duty. So was Detective Janet Heisinger. Detective Kyle Ostov was available, however, and when he came on the line, he sounded reassuringly big and competent. His voice was a mellow baritone, and he spoke crisply. Lee identified himself, aware that his own voice was higher than usual, almost squeaky, and that he was speaking too fast. "There's been a murder." Before Lee could go on, Ostov said, "Jesus, you mean Bobby and Julie know already? I just found out myself. It was pushed on me to tell them, and I was just sitting here, trying to figure out how best to break the news. I had my hand on the phone, going to call them when you rang through. How are they taking it?" Confused, Lee said, "I don't know. I don't think they know. I mean, it must have happened just a few minutes ago." "A little longer than that," Ostov said. "When did you guys find out? I just looked, and there weren't any patrol cars, nothing." Finally, the shakes hit him. "God, I was talking to him not that long ago. Took him some pizza, and now he's splashed all over the concrete 6 floors down." Ostov was silent then. "What murder are you talking about, Lee?" "Hal Yamataka. There must have been a fight here, and then..." He stopped and blinked and said, "What murder are you talking about?" "Thomas," Ostov said. Lee felt sick. He had only met Thomas once, but he knew that Julie and Bobby were devoted to him. Ostov said Thomas and his roommate, and maybe more, in the fire, if they didn't get them all out of the building in time. The computer that Lee had been born with was not functioning as smoothly as the ones made by IBM in his office, and he needed a moment to grasp the implications of the information that he and Ostov had exchanged. They've got to be connected, don't they? I'd bet on it. You know of anybody who has a grudge against Julie and Bobby? Lee looked around the reception lounge, thought about the other deserted rooms at Dakota and Dakota, the lonely offices on the rest of the sixth floor, and the unpeopled levels below the sixth. He thought of Candy, too, all those people bitten and torn. The giant Bobby had seen on Punaloo Beach. The way the guy could zap himself from place to place. He began to feel very much alone. Detective Ostov, could you get some people here really fast? I've entered the call on the computer while I've been talking with you, Ostov said. A couple of units are on their way now.
With his fingertips, Candy traced lazy circles on the surface of the dresser, then explored the contours of each brass handle on the drawers. He touched the light switch on the wall and the switches on both bedside lamps. He let his hands glide over door frames on the off chance that one of his intended prey might have paused and leaned there while in conversation, examined the handles on the mirrored closet doors, and caressed each number and switch pad on the remote control device for the TV, hoping that they had clicked on the set even during the short time they had been home. Nothing. Because he needed to be calm and methodical in his search if he were to succeed, Candy had to repress his rage and frustration. But his anger grew even as he struggled to contain it, and in him the thirst of anger was always a thirst for blood, that wine of vengeance. Only blood would slake his thirst, quench his fury, and allow him an interlude of relative peace. By the time he moved from the Dakota's bedroom into the adjoining bath, Candy was possessed of a need for blood almost as undeniable and critical as his need for air. Looking at the mirror, he did not see himself for a moment, as if he cast no reflection. He saw only red blood, as if the mirror were a porthole on one of the lower decks of a ship in hell, on a cruise through a sea of gore. When that illusion faded and he saw his own face, he quickly looked away. He clenched his jaws, struggled even harder to control himself, and touched the hot water faucet, searching, seeking.
The motel room in Santa Barbara was spacious, quiet, clean, and furnished without the jarring clash of colors and patterns that seemed de rigueur in most American motels. But it was not a place in which Julie would have chosen to receive the terrible news that came to her there. The blow seemed greater, the ache in the heart more piercing, for having to be born in a strange and impersonal place. She really had thought that Bobby was letting his imagination run away with him again, that Thomas was perfectly fine. Because the phone was on the nightstand, he sat on the edge of the bed to make the call, and Julie watched him and listened from a chair only a few feet away. When he got that recording again, explaining that the Cielo Vista number was temporarily out of service due to line problems, she was vaguely uneasy, but still sure that all was well with her brother. However, when he called the office in Newport to talk with Hal, got Lee Chen instead, and spent the first minute or so listening in shocked silence, responding with a cryptic word or two, she knew this was to be a night that cleaved her life, and that the years to come inevitably would be darker than the years she had lived on the other side of that cleft. As he began to ask questions of Lee, Bobby avoided looking at Julie, which confirmed her intuition and made her heart pound faster. When at last he glanced at her, she had to look away from the sadness in his eyes. His questions to Lee were clipped, and she couldn't ascertain much from them. Maybe she didn't want to. Finally, the call seemed to be drawing to an end. No, you've done well, Lee. Keep handling it just the way you have been. What? Oh, thank you, Lee. No, we'll be all right. We'll be okay, Lee. One way or another, we'll be okay. When Bobby hung up, He sat for a moment staring at his hands, which he clasped between his knees. Julie did not ask him what had happened, as if what Lee had told him was not yet fact, as if her question was a dark magic, and as if the unrevealed tragedy would not become real until she asked about it. Bobby got off the bed and knelt on the floor in front of her chair. He took both of her hands in his and gently kissed them. She knew then that the news was as bad as it could get. Softly he said, "Thomas is dead." She had steeled herself for that news, but the words cut deep. "I'm sorry, Julie. God, I'm so sorry. And it doesn't end there." He told her about hell. And just a couple of minutes before he talked to me, Lee received a call about Clint and Felina, both dead. The horror was too much to assimilate. Julie had liked and respected Hal, Clint, and Felina enormously, and her admiration for the deaf woman's courage and self-sufficiency was unbounded. It was unfair that she could not mourn each of them individually. They deserved that much. She also felt that she was somehow betraying them because her sorrow at their deaths was only a pale reflection of the grief she felt at the loss of Thomas, though that was, of course, the only way it could be. Her breath caught in her throat, and when it flew free, it was not just an exhalation, but a sob. That was no good. She could not allow herself to break down. At no point in her life had she needed to be as strong as she needed to be now. The murders committed in Orange County tonight were the first in a domino fall of death that would take down her and Bobby, too, if misery dulled their edge. While Bobby continued to kneel before her and reveal more details, Derek was dead, too, and perhaps others at Cielo Vista, she gripped his hands tightly, inexpressibly grateful to have him for an anchor in her turbulence. Her vision was blurry, but she held back the tears with a sheer effort of will, though she dared not make eye contact with Bobby just yet. That would be the end of her self-control. When he finished, she said, "It was Frank's brother, of course," and was dismayed by the way her voice quavered. "Almost certainly," Bobby said. "But how did he find out Frank was our client?" "I don't know. He saw me on the beach at Punalu."
"Yeah, but he didn't follow you. He had no way of knowing who you were. And for God's sake, how did he find out about Thomas?"
"There's some crucial bit of information missing, so we can't understand the pattern."
"What's the bastard after?" she said.
Now her voice was marked by nearly as much anger as grief, and that was good. "He's hunting Frank," Bobby said. "For 7 years, Frank was a loner, and that made him harder to find. Now Frank has friends, and that gives Candy more ways to search for him."
"I as good as killed Thomas when I took this case," she said.
"You didn't want to take it. I had to talk you into it. I talked you into it. You wanted to back out. If there's guilt, we share it, but there isn't any. We took on a new client, that's all, and everything just happened."
Julie nodded and met his eyes. Although his voice had remained steady, tears slid down his cheeks. Preoccupied with her own grief, she had forgotten that the friends lost were his as well as hers, and that he had come to love Thomas nearly as much as she did. She had to look away from him again. "Are you okay?" he asked.
"For now, I have to be. Later, I want to talk about Thomas, how brave he was about being different, how he never complained, and how sweet he was. I want to talk about all of it, you and me, and I don't want us to forget. Nobody's ever going to build a monument to Thomas. He wasn't famous. He was just a little guy who never did anything except be the best person he knew how. And the only monument he's ever going to have is our memories. So we'll keep him alive, won't we?"
"Yes.
We'll keep him alive until we're gone. But that's for later, when there's time. Now we have to keep ourselves alive, because that son of a bitch will be coming for us, won't he?"
"I think he will," Bobby said.
He rose from his knees and pulled her up from the chair. He was wearing his dark brown ultra suede jacket with the shoulder holster under it. She had taken off her corduroy blazer and her holster. She put both of them on again. The weight of the revolver against her left side felt good. She hoped she'd have a chance to use it. Her vision had cleared, her eyes were dry. She said, "One thing for sure. No more dreams for me. What good is it having dreams when they never come true? Sometimes they do. No, they never came true for my mom and dad, never came true for Thomas, did they? Ask Clint and Felina if their dreams came true. See what they say. You ask George Ferris's family if they think being slaughtered by a maniac was a fulfillment of their dreams. Ask the Fonz," Bobby said quietly. "They were boat people on the South China Sea with hardly any food and less money. And now they own dry cleaning shops and remodel $200,000 houses for resale. And they have those terrific kids. Sooner or later they'll get it in the neck too," she said, unsettled by the bitterness in her voice and the black despair that churned up like a whirlpool within her, threatening to swallow her up. But she could not stop churning. "Ask Park Hempstead down there in El Toro whether he and his wife were thrilled when she developed terminal cancer, and ask him how his dream about him and Marilee Roman worked after he finally got over the death of his wife. Nasty bugger named Candy got in the way of that one. Ask all the poor suckers lying in the hospital with cerebral hemorrhages, cancer. Ask those who get Alzheimer's in their 50s, just when their golden years are supposed to start. Ask little kids in wheelchairs from muscular dystrophy. And ask all the parents of those other kids down there in Cielo Vista how Down syndrome fits in with their dreams. Ask..." She cut herself off. She was losing control, and she could not afford to do so tonight. She said, "Come on. Let's go." "Where?" "First we find the house where that bitch raised him. Cruise by, get the lay of it. Maybe just seeing it will give us ideas." "I've seen it." "I haven't." "All right." From a nightstand drawer, he removed a telephone directory for Santa Barbara, Montecito, Goleta, Hope Ranch, El Encanto Heights, and other surrounding communities. He brought it with him to the door. She said, "What do you want that for?" "We'll need it later. I'll explain in the car." Sprinkles of rain were falling again. The Toyota's engine was still so hot from the drive north that in spite of the cool night air, steam rose from its hood as the beads of rainwater evaporated. Far away, a brief low peal of thunder rolled across the sky. Thomas was dead.
He received images as faint and distorted as reflections on the wind-rippled surface of a pond. They came repeatedly as he touched the faucets, the rim of the sink, the mirror, the medicine cabinet and its contents, the light switch, the controls for the shower. But none of his visions was detailed, and none provided a clue as to where the Dakotas had gone. Twice he was jolted by vivid images, but they were related to disgusting sexual episodes between the Dakotas. A tube of vaginal lubricant and a box of Kleenex were contaminated with older psychic residue that had inexplicably lingered beyond its time, making him privy to sinful practices that he had no desire to witness. He quickly snatched his hands away from those surfaces and waited for his nausea to pass. He was incensed that the need to track Frank through these decadent people had forced him into a situation where his senses had been so brutally affronted. Infuriated by his lack of success and by the unclean contact with images of their sin which he seemed unable to expel from his mind, he decided that he must burn the evil out of this house in the name of God. Burn it out, incinerate it, so that maybe his mind would be cleansed again as well. He stepped out of the bathroom, raised his hands, and sent an immensely destructive wave of power across the bedroom. The wooden headboard of the big bed disintegrated. Flames leaped from the quilted spread and blankets. The nightstands flew apart, and every drawer in the dresser shot out and dumped its contents on the floor, where they instantly caught fire. The drapes were consumed as if made from magician's flash paper, and the two windows in the far wall burst, letting in a draft that fanned the blaze. Candy often wished the mysterious light that came from him could affect people and animals rather than just inanimate things, plants and a few insects. There were times when he would have gone into a city and melted the flesh from the bones of 10,000 sinners in a single night. 100,000. It didn't matter which city. They were all festering sewers of iniquity, populated by depraved masses who worshipped evil and practiced every repulsive degeneracy. He had never seen anyone in any of them, not a single person, who seemed to him to live in God's grace. He would have made them run screaming in terror, would have tracked them down in their secret places, would have splintered their bones with his power, hammered their flesh to pulp, made their heads explode, and torn off the offensive sex things that preoccupied them. If he had been that gifted, he would not have shown them any of the mercy with which their Creator always treated them, so they would have realized then how grateful and obedient they should have been to their God, who always so patiently tolerated even their worst transgressions. Only God and Candy's mother had such unlimited compassion. He did not share it. The smoke alarm went off in the hall. He walked out there, pointed a finger at it, and blew it to bits. This part of his gift seemed more powerful tonight than ever. He was a great engine of destruction. The Lord must be rewarding his purity by increasing his power. He thanked God that his own saintly mother had never descended into the pits of depravity in which so much of humanity swam. No man had ever touched her that way. So her children were born without the stain of original sin. He knew this to be true, for she had told him, and had shown him that it was. He descended to the first floor and set the living room carpet on fire with a bolt from his left hand. Frank and the twins had never appreciated the immaculate aspect of their conceptions, and in fact had thrown away that incomparable state of grace to embrace sin and do the devil's work. Candy would never make that mistake. Overhead he heard the roar of flames, the crash of a partition. In the morning, when the sun revealed a smoldering pile of blackened rubble, the remains of this nest of corruption would be a testament to the ultimate perdition of all sinners. Candy felt cleansed. The psychic images of the Dakota's fevered degeneracy had been expunged from his mind. He returned to the offices of Dakota and Dakota to continue his search for them.
Bobby drove, for he didn't think Julie ought to be behind the wheel anymore tonight. She'd been awake for more than 19 hours, not a marathon all-nighter yet, but she was exhausted, and her bottled-up grief over Thomas's death could not help but cloud her judgment and dull her reflexes. At least he had napped a couple of times since Hal's call from the hospital had awakened them last night. He crossed most of Santa Barbara and entered Goleta before bothering to look for a service station where they could ask for directions to Pacific Hill Road. At his request, Julie opened the telephone directory on her lap, and with the assistance of a small flashlight taken from the glove compartment, she looked under the F's for Fogarty. He didn't know the first name, but he was only interested in a male Fogarty, who carried the title of doctor. He might not live in this area, Bobby said, but I have a hunch he does. Who is he? When Frank and I were traveling, we stopped in this guy's study twice. He told her about both brief visits. Well, how come you didn't mention him before? At the office, when I told you what happened to me, where Frank and I had gone, I had to condense some of it, and this Fogarty seemed comparatively uninteresting, so I left him out. But the longer I've had time to think about it, the more it seems to me that he might be a key player in this. See, Frank popped us out of there so fast because he seemed especially reluctant to endanger Fogarty by leading Candy to him. If Frank's especially concerned about the man, then we ought to have a talk with him. She hunched over the directory, studying it closely. Fogarty James, Fogarty Jennifer, Fogarty Kevin. If he's not a medical doctor and doesn't use the title daily, or if Doc's a nickname, we're in trouble.